Please be seated. Next case on the court's calendar is David Tercios. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Versus the State of Nevada, case number 64918. Ms. Bachman, are you ready to go?
I am. May it please the court. My name is Shauna Bachman. I am a Clark County Public Defender, and I represent David Tercios in this matter. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Tercios was convicted at trial of 15 counts of charges that involve life sentences, and he is currently serving his time in prison. This case is about a man with questionable capabilities who had a belief that he was forced to represent himself at trial. And when he eventually did go to trial, he went forward without potentially exculpatory discovery. I'd like to first talk about the Feretta canvas. Feretta lays out the requirements for self-representation. The court said that the trial judge, in a case where self-representation is being requested, must make certain that the defendant understands the charges, the potential penalties, and the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. Essentially, the record must establish that he's walking into it with his eyes wide open. In the Nevada case, Hooks, this court made it a little bit clearer and said that the defendant must have a clear comprehension of the attendant risks. Mr. Tercios clearly did not enter self-representation knowingly and intelligently. First, he had a ninth grade education. He also had no experience with the criminal justice system. When he was asked whether he understood that he would get no special privileges just because he wasn't a lawyer, his response was, "I'm not searching for that, ma'am."
Well, what's a judge to do in this type of situation? You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. There's going to be an appellate issue either way. Either they force you to keep your public defender, or you go bareback into a trial, which, of course, I've yet to see a proper person be able to handle cases like this with life sentences. And he had a good attorney. He had one of the best public defenders. That was a bad move on his part.
Absolutely.
Bad move.
And, Your Honor, we believe firmly in Feretta that, you know, defendants have a right to self-representation if they so choose. But it is incumbent upon the trial court to make a penetrating and comprehensive inquiry into all of the reasons that the defendant wants to represent himself.
And that's I don't read Feretta and Hooks that way, because I was involved in Hooks. And I thought maybe we cut back on Feretta. The Feretta's the United States Supreme Court, that's what they say. But in the trenches, you know, that's how it happens. It's more like Hooks. If you're warm and you can talk to the judge with being comprehensive to the judge, that's enough.
I do think that it has to be an individual case basis. But in this case, he answered question after question non-responsively. He answered to the question, "Do you understand the elements of the charges?" And he said, "So far, I understand one critical point, that if P, the complaining witness, withdraw the accusation against me."
Counsel, as to that particular point, didn't the court at length walk him through, because of that response, the elements of the various charges and ask him at the end, "Do you understand?"
The court did tell him, "You are charged with 15 felonies," and told him the elements of each of the charges.
And at the end of each one, he asked him.
He never said, "Yes, I understand." He never once said,
"Yes,
I understand."
Did he make an affirmative response? Did he make an affirmative response of understanding, though?
I believe he said when the judge asked him, "These are the elements," and he said, "Yes."
Well, I think it went further. I went through the Feretta canvas, and I went through what the judge explained very specifically to him, and it looked like she was very careful about going through that. And after she reviewed all of this, I believe he stated that he wished to represent himself, and that the quote was, he was very confident in the truth, and the truth will come out, and it will be said that after the jury will understand, and even the court will be impressed. And that's a quote. And that's, you know, that's fairly compelling to me that that he understood what he was getting into. And just as Justice Cherry said, you know, he's got a right to represent himself. And what do you do in this situation? I mean, how far do you go?
And Justice Gregory, I do remember when he said, I believe in the truth. I believe that the truth will come out. But he said at least three times, the only reason that I want to represent myself is I don't want to hurt Mr. Speed's reputation. The only reason I'm doing this is I don't want to jeopardize Mr. Speed. And again, at the end, in response to the question, do you understand that self-representation is not necessarily in your best interest? He said, like I said, the only reason is because I don't want him to be put in a position where he might get in trouble.
And so wasn't going to ask that particular issue. I mean, we're dancing around it, but there were some witnesses that the addresses or whereabouts of them had not been given to the public defender's office. They just found out counsel possibly was going to ask to have the trial continued. The defendant didn't want the trial continued. He wanted to go ahead.
And that's the interesting thing.
But it was not really expressed on the record.
Right, that it's never expressed on the record. And we can only take that to mean that he didn't understand that he could ask for more time or that he had other choices. And in this case, it seems as though the trial court judge had an obligation to ask him more questions about what that conflict was, why he believed that, and to consider appointing alternate counsel. And the fact that the request was made only 4 days before trial was to begin, and there is a case directly on point in Nevada, O'Neill v. State, where the request was denied 3 days before trial by the trial court judge, and no error was found there because the court said, you know, that it would contaminate the proceedings, essentially.
Well, I think it's a challenge to suggest that the judge didn't ask as many questions as possible, but I do think there is an odd thing in the defendant's response. I don't see a conflict between the defendant and Mr. Speed being expressed. He says he wants to protect Mr. Speed's reputation. From what? It was just an odd response. So is there an articulated conflict that I'm not seeing?
And Justice Hardesty, that was never put on the record, what the conflict was. And that's something that we wish we knew. It is a sign, however, of duress, and a sign that he felt he had to represent himself, that he had to go forward by himself because he didn't want to harm Mr. Speed.
But is it necessary to show the existence of a conflict with counsel, court-appointed counsel, in order for the defendant to choose to represent themselves?
I think that if he had answered the Feretta canvas, answered the questions in the Feretta canvas in a way that demonstrated that it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, that then it wouldn't matter if there was a conflict with counsel. Mm-hmm. But because he was never told that he would have to register as a sex offender, he was never told that he would be under lifetime supervision, or that he would have to undergo a psychosexual evaluation in order to be released on parole. he didn't understand all of the possible consequences and penalties. And so the Feretta canvas itself was invalid, and he wasn't capable of representing himself, and particularly not 11 days after that Feretta canvas.
Let me ask you, are you suggesting maybe that we do a very narrow reading of Cripps and that Judge Vega should have taken the defendant and Mr. Speed into chambers without the district attorney being there and tried to work this out as far as self-representation? In other words, would you like me to say that in an opinion or an order? Would you go that far? And so that we put our judges on notice that you're not going to have these people representing themselves?
I don't think so. I think that on a case-by-case basis, that would be too much. It would be too far. But in a case where there's an indication that there's some kind of conflict that hasn't been fully articulated, I think that it is incumbent upon the trial judge to find out more information before granting him the right to represent himself.
Ms. Bachman, you reserved some time, but is there another point or two you want to hit on, or do you want to wait until we...
No, I will wait until the end.
Okay. All right. Ms. Triskin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, with all these young observers, I'm going to ask you... What do you think about my idea of, as a DA, if you were the trial attorney in this, if Judge Vega had said, Mr. Speed, defendant, let's go into chambers and talk about this, without the DA being put in? How do you feel about that? How would Mr. Wolfson feel about that?
Well, first of all, Rajan Iskamp for the respondent. I don't want to speak out of turn for Mr. Wolfson, but for my personal...
I do all the time, so...
my personal opinion, Judge, I don't think that's a good idea, because I think Feretta... And the case law of this state itself guarantees the right of self-representation to a defendant. It's a constitutional right. And I think this court has said over and over again that that the defendant has a right to represent himself as long as the waiver there's been a canvas conducted and the waiver is knowing and intelligent.
Is it structural error, though, if Judge Vega had denied the self-representation motion by the defendant? In other words, and then he'd been convicted and it would have been, is it structural error if we found there was a violation there for that?
Well, I assume if...
Like using Mr. Speed in the case. In other words, what if she had said, no, I'm going to have... Mr. Speed's going to be here, not a standby counsel. He's going to represent you and you keep your mouth shut.
And I agree, it's a difficult question. It's kind of like you mentioned earlier, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because, I mean, the Constitution does protect a defendant's right to represent themselves. And if the trial court forces counsel on a person, that could raise a different constitutional issue.
Do you think it's structural error, though? Would it be structural error?
I don't think so. I think in this particular case, or in cases like this in general, I mean, this court has said, and I believe also in Lyons v. State, this court, again, that was specifically addressing the timeliness of when the request for self-representation is made, but the court in that case also encouraged trial courts to try to accommodate these requests when possible, basically saying that defendants do have a constitutional right and that should be honored should that request be made to the extent that it's at all possible. And I think that's what Judge Vega did in this particular case. And I would also echo, I believe it might have been the Justice Douglas that said it, that Judge Vega went through a very penetrating canvas. In fact, she employed Supreme Court Rule 253 that this court has promulgated to aid district court judges in conducting that canvas and wading through the issues that need to be waded through in order to determine if a defendant's request for substantiation is made knowingly and voluntarily. And I think she followed it to a T. I think I went through it myself, and her questions were almost taken exactly from the Supreme Court rule. And in every single step of the process, the defendant agreed. And one thing I want to say is the defendant, ill-advised or not, did not suffer from a lack of confidence in going through this canvas. He was ready to go to trial, and he thought that it was in his best interest to do so himself, and he made that perfectly clear. In going through the canvas, he said that he thinks he'd do a better job. And this is a direct quote. I believe I'll come out on top when we're done with this. He understood the felony counts he was facing. He wasn't seeking special treatment. And I believe Justice Perry also quoted the defendant when he said that, you know, he even thinks Judge Vega would be impressed when he was done with his case. So he was ready to go to trial. And as far as the issue of, the possible conflict, I think it was, to the extent that through the entire trial record, I think it became clear that any potential conflict or anything that Mr. Tercios was worried about according to Mr. Speed's representation was in regard to Mr. Speed's request for a continuance when he wanted to go to trial. I mean, he made it a point when Judge Vega asked him, well, you're going to trial on September 9th, and this question was asked on September 5th, 4 days before trial, and his immediate response was, all right, let's go. And he commented that he'd been in custody for a year and 9 months. It's been a lot for me. So he was ready to go to trial. And when Mr. Speed made his request for a continuance, he then brought up the defendant's request for a Feretta canvas and represented himself, and he said that his request dovetails with Mr. Churchill's request to represent himself. And later, it did come out initially during the colloquy or the waiver canvas, but there was an exchange later between Judge Vega and Mr. Speed, where Judge Vega said her understanding was the defendant's request to represent himself was based on his desire to move forward with the trial, not continue it. And Mr. Speed acknowledged that was, in fact, a reason why the defendant wanted to represent himself.
So could that be considered error on the behalf of Judge Vega by not just granting a continuance and letting Mr. Speed and the defendant work things out?
That wasn't all that it was. He wanted to go to trial, and he thought that he would be able to represent his interest the best himself, because there was a point during the waiver colloquy where he talks about jeopardizing Mr. Speed's position, and the court then challenged him and said, well, that shouldn't be the only reason why you elect to represent yourself. And he said, well, there's several things he wants to address in front of the jury, and he was in the best position to handle that. So he felt in his mind, again, ill-advised or not, that he was in the best position to present his defense. Now, to remind the court that under Feretta and also this court in Tanksley, it's not the technical legal knowledge represented by the defendant or exhibited by the defendant during the trial. It's not his confidence to represent himself. It's whether the waiver was knowing and intelligent. And I think in this case, it exactly was that. And regarding the issue of the timeliness of the request, it is true that the request came on the eve of trial. I believe the Feretta canvas was conducted right before trial started. But I think, again, this court in Lyons gives the trial court a lot of discretion as far as when and under what circumstances to grant the request. I believe there's three standards that were articulated in Lyons. One was that if the request is made well before the trial, it's timely, and that the trial court should basically, it's time as a matter of law, the trial court should grant the request. If it's made shortly before or even on the day of trial, the district court has discretion to deny the request unless reasonable cause to justify delay is given. And finally, even if the request is made in the middle of trial, the district court is still granted discretion. So what that says to me is that this court contemplated a situation where a defendant may elect, even in the middle of trial, after having begun the trial with an attorney, say, you know what, I want to represent myself. And even in those circumstances, this court has given the trial court discretion to grant that request even in the middle of trial. So in this case, it was done before trial, and in fact, Judge Vega granted the defendant a request for a one-week continuance. Now, that's also something I want to point out is that Mr. Speed was appointed a standby counsel. He was present during the entirety of these proceedings. I mean, he's sitting behind me in this court now, and it's exactly where he was throughout the entirety of the trial in Judge Vega's courtroom. And he was available to assist Mr. Tercios, and I would note that Mr. Tercios' request for a one-week continuance came after Mr. Speed was conferring with him during the court proceedings. With Judge Vega made a point to point out on the record that the defendant was conferring with Mr. Tercios. At that point, the judge granted a one-week continuance, which wasn't, in my opinion, a one-due delay. We were able to all accommodate that. The witnesses were available. The trial was moved 1 week, and we commenced 1 week later. So all in all, I believe that there was a valid waiver of the defendant's right to counsel. I think that it was, as far as timeliness, the court had discretion to grant that request. The court exercised discretion. And I would also point out that this court in Gray said that we should defer to the trial court because the trial court's in the best decision to evaluate the waiver, because the trial court sees the demeanor and the mannerisms of the defendant during the course of the waiver, and it doesn't have to rely on a poor record as this court does. So I believe Judge Vega's decision was entitled to deference and that the waiver was knowing and intelligent and voluntary, and I don't see any problems with it. And I think that, again, his ability to represent himself is not the issue. And I know Ms. Brockman pointed out that he had questionable capabilities, but again, that's not the inquiry. The inquiry is whether he went in there with his eyes open, and I believe that he did.
Does Freda talk about standby counsel? I don't remember.
I don't recall if Freda specifically addressed standby counsel. I apologize for that. But I would point out that the reason I brought that up is that, and this was a discussion that was had between the attorneys and the judge in the middle of trial, is that should there be a time, and this was done in Mr. Churchill's presence, so he could hear this, that Mr. Churchill selected to, well, you know what, this is not, I'm in over my head, I don't know what I'm doing here. He could defer to Mr. Speed, he could ask Mr. Speed questions at any time, and he could ask Mr. Speed to step in at any point if he felt that it was necessary. So the fact that, excuse me, that standby counsel was available also gives him an avenue should his decision to represent himself, should he deem that to have not been in his best interest at any point during the trial, which he never elected to do.
This circumstance causes me a concern, though, where Tercios asked to recall the complaining witness and the judge denies that request. When you're dealing with someone who's representing themselves, perhaps not very familiar with court process, and wants to call the complaining witness back in his case, did the judge abuse her discretion in rejecting that request?
I don't think there there was an abuse of discretion, because in this particular case, the defendant had a full opportunity to cross-examine the complaining witness. His cross-examination was not limited by the court in any way. He asked several questions, and he, in some instances, was able to delve into possible biases that the victim would have. Potential, I think his theory was that this young girl and her friends got together and basically fabricated his allegations against him. So he's asking her about her relationships with her friends, how this particular allegation may have arose.
But PB is the first witness in the case.
She was the first witness.
And so this individual's obviously flying by the seat of his pants and defending himself, which is probably not a very good idea. But why shouldn't the court allow him to recall PB? I mean, now all of the witnesses have testified. There may be issues that came up in that testimony that he wants to cover with the primary complaining witness.
Well, I don't think he ever provided a reason as to why he wanted to recall the witness. I think possibly the court was also trying to weigh the the balance between recalling this young girl who had to face questioning from the very person that she was accusing of sexually abusing her. And I think the court made a record that the defendant did not make any showing as to what the reason why he would want to recall her. And I'd also remind the court that under abuse of discretion review, there also has to be prejudice to the defendant. And that's something that was brought up several times during the appellant's briefs, that there was no other evidence beyond the victim's testimony, that the state's entire case rested on her credibility. And I would say that would be a colorable argument should that be the case, that since our entire case rested on her, the court should have allowed the defendant to recall the witness. But we had the defendant's own statement. Now, the defense believes that statement should not come into evidence. I can obviously address that with this court, should the court have questions about that, but I think that statement was perfectly admissible. There was a full Jackson v. Denno evidentiary hearing where all those issues were ferreted out. And the statement did come in the trial, and the trial court knew that. And so I don't think the trial court on balance thought, well, is his rights really going to be affected if he's not allowed to recall her because of the admissions that he made? I mean, how would the outcome of the trial have been different, I think, is what the standard is. Should he have been allowed to recall this witness, possibly cross-examine her or ask her some more questions to ferret out some more potential biases or motivation to fabricate? But at the end of the day, the state still had that his admissions where he corroborated several aspects of the abuse that she detailed in this case. So I don't think there was abuse of discretion.
Could you address the counseling records? And your brief suggests this, the record shows that the state did not possess those records.
We did not. We did not possess those records. Those were records held by a private counseling agency. My personal belief is I believe those records are privileged, and they should only be divulged should the court deem it necessary. And that was a motion that was brought by the district court, I'm sorry, by Mr. Speed in front of the district court. And the state opposed that on the grounds that it was privileged, that it was, there was no showing of materiality.
But the state didn't, the court didn't review those records in camera.
The court did not review those records in camera. And because the court made a decision that the defense did not provide any materiality as far as why those records would have shown something that the court should review. And again, I would remind the court that although the appellant attempts to paint this as a Brady issue, Brady really only applies to evidence the state has in its possession and withholds. This is more a falls under means v. state, where the court has to review this as an abuse of discretion as far as a defendant's right to discovery. And under abuse of discretion, it also has to be a review of prejudice.
Well, considering the defendant's statement also, this would be harmless at best.
Right. And that's my, basically my position. And I think that's why the court did not want to the court made a point of saying that there would be a chilling effect should the court be diving into these records when there's a situation where the defendant made these admissions. And I think that's what the court was ultimately concerned with. I would want to make a quick point about the Wyman case that the court, that the appellant cited in its reply brief. I think that is completely distinguishable from this position between the situation in this case because in Wyman, the defendant was attempting to gather records that exist in the state of California. And this court made a point, I'll just make this my last comment, that the court shouldn't review privilege or consider privilege because those were ISA records, and privilege should be decided by the court having jurisdiction over those records. And in this particular case, the court did have jurisdiction over the records. I think it was proper for the court to consider privilege. And again, under the abuse of discretion review, with his admissions, I don't think that the court made an improper determination. And unless there's further questions, I thank the court.
I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Erskine.
Thank you.
Ms. Bachman?
I'd like to start with the counseling records. The case that should be focused on here is Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, which set the balance between privileged documents and the defendant's due process rights. And that process was an in-camera review. And because that wasn't done in this case, we don't know if there was exculpatory.
But isn't Pennsylvania's law slightly different from the law in this state?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Other states have followed Pennsylvania v. Ritchie. The Supreme Court of Utah in State v. Cano applied Ritchie to their decision, saying that the defendant was entitled to directly request psych records. The Delaware Court of Appeals in Burns v. State also did so.
And Utah's exception to the privilege is almost identical to Nevada's. We have a recent case on that neither side cited, but I was intrigued by your reference to Utah law on that, which is that, as I understand the Utah case, that the defense was that the victim was lying or fabricating, and that became an element of the defense, and because the exception said if it's an element of a claim or defense, the privilege disappears, that then that justified the in-camera review statutorily. Is that an overreading of that Utah case or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but I do think that the gist of the reason that they applied Pennsylvania v. Ritchie to that case was that there was simply some showing that the case, that there was materiality. In Burns,
what was the showing here of materiality?
And the showing here, Mr. Speed, in his second discovery motion, stated in the facts, we have found out that she's going to counseling and that she's cutting herself and that he's saying things to her friends and they're worried about her, and that there were some kind of statements tying the accusations to her mental state. And that's also the, that is also the standard that's used in Wyman, that there is some kind of correlation between those two things. And so once a showing of materiality is there, I believe that an in-camera review is the least that should happen. And if there is anything exculpatory in that material, then the defense is absolutely entitled to it.
I'm still trying to understand what the materiality was. I don't know that Justice Pickering's question was answered. It certainly wasn't for my purposes, because in my reading, I don't see anything other than an expression that there was an argument that the evidence he saw may have contained inconsistent statements, and that was about it.
And then our position is that the things she was saying, the self-cutting, that she had, that was tied to the abuse that she was alleging. And that's language taken from Ritchie and Burns in the Delaware Supreme Court.
Counsel, in all fairness, two things. One, you talk about exculpatory. I think it was categorized by the other side that this was just merely a fishing expedition. Yes. But the other is that there was no showing that this behavior that you might wish to point as abnormal had occurred prior to the alleged incidents that occurred.
There was no showing that it had occurred, that it was separate. Is that the question?
Yes, this behavior, the cutting or whatever, did not begin to occur until after the sexual assaults.
And that's true, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter is that we don't know exactly when it happened because we were never allowed to see the contents of the counseling records. And that was something we believe we are entitled to.
Do you contend that the state had those records, or do you agree with counsel that there's nothing in this record that shows that the state had them?
We do not think that the state had them, no. And we were not...
You're not making that argument.
No, but we do believe that the state has obligations under Brady to provide anything that may be exculpatory. So
I want to understand your materiality argument, and I'm sorry to keep pressing you. Can you, in a sentence or two, tell me what the argument was made to the district court, why those counseling records may have been material?
We discovered that she had started going to counseling and was telling people, the same people who then testified at trial, that she was cutting herself, that she was really upset, that, you know, her friends were worried about her. And it was the timeline of that happening that ties it right back to the accusations. And that's almost identical to the situation in Wyman. And I realize that Wyman is different in that it dealt with out-of-state witnesses. But as far as the rest of the matter, the materiality is the same. And there was a good chance that there was something in those counseling records that would have shed some light on what was going on in her mind. And the defense should have been allowed to see those.
Okay. Thank you very much for your arguments, Ms. Bachman and Mr. Eskay. The case will stand submitted.